Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to call the Jobs and Economic Growth Committee to order. Thank you all for being here. I understand we're running a little bit late. The Tax Committee was going a little bit over, but I'm very excited this morning. We have a great speaker from Wells Fargo. We have economist Scott Anderson. And Scott is a world-renowned economist, actually was named by USA Today as one of the top 10 in the country. And also, I believe I've seen you on CNBC and a few other TV shows around the country, around the networks also. So, Scott, thank you for joining us today. We're looking forward to your presentation.
Thanks for having me. Well, good morning, everyone. Chairman Lilly, other members of the committee, I am pleased to have this opportunity to offer my views on the U.S. and Minnesota economic outlook. I think I'll start this morning with a broad overview of the U.S. economic outlook and the prospects for private sector job growth, consumer spending, housing and home prices, and business investment. And then I'll discuss how this U.S. outlook, what it likely means for the Minnesota's economic prospects in the quarters ahead. Both the U.S. and Minnesota economies started to show signs of recovery in the second half of 2009. We started to see sporadic Minnesota job growth in October of 2009. The U.S. appeared to follow a little bit behind Minnesota, and we started to see steady job growth in the United States around March of 2010. Of course, the official end of the Great Recession was the second quarter of 2009. I'm happy to report this morning that recent U.S. economic data suggests that the national economic recovery is gathering some pace and strength. Most economic releases over the past few months have been stronger than consensus expectations. And of particular note, I would point out that consumers and consumer spending returned in the fourth quarter. Real consumer spending grew at a 4.4% annualized pace nationally in the fourth quarter, and that's extremely important. It's certainly a key ingredient for the economic recovery because consumer spending makes up 70% of our economy. A couple important drivers here. We are seeing pent-up demand now being spent among the nation's consumers, particularly in the auto sector. We're seeing stronger income growth as the economy continues to grow. And, of course, stock market gains are very important here. I think this morning the S&P 500 is up more than 100% from the March 2009 lows, and that's helping to build household wealth, and that's some of that wealth is starting to get spent again. We're also seeing less deleveraging among U.S. households, and the drag from deleveraging and increases in household savings rates will be less of a drag going forward. So this is what we really need, and it's certainly key to building a self-sustaining economic growth environment. It's certainly helping to re-energize our manufacturing sector. We're seeing signs now that we're seeing another increase in new orders and depleted inventories, and that's going to be so we're sort of starting on this virtuous cycle of private sector demand beginning to lead to more production, and that, of course, leading to more private sector demand. That's what we need to have underway to begin this self-sustaining recovery. I also anticipate improved job growth in 2011. A lot of the leading indicators we track around the U.S. labor market are improving. We've seen nice increases in the ISM manufacturing and non-manufacturing surveys, suggesting solid job growth ahead. Initial jobless claims, probably our most visible and most timely indicator of layoffs, has dropped below 400,000 the first time in this recovery. And even data that we collect among our small business customers at Wells Fargo certainly pointing to the fact that small business optimism is ramping up very rapidly now, and we do expect that really for the first time in this recovery, small businesses will be participating in the recovery in 2011. That probably means a stronger job growth environment. The third point I'd like to make today is on the economic policy front, at the national level at least, both monetary and fiscal policies are going to be more stimulative than we expected just 6 months ago. We had, of course, the extension of the Bush tax cuts. But also we had some additional Christmas gifts in there, including a 2% cut in the payroll tax, as well extension of unemployment benefits, which I think will help lead to a stronger trend growth rate in consumer spending. So it looks like we're going to have another solid year of economic growth, somewhat above what we saw in 2010, and this should put put enough momentum behind this recovery that some of the national policymakers will begin to be able to scale back some of the stimulus that have been put in place since the financial crisis began in early 2008. But let's talk a little bit about where we've been, and that was sort of my entree, and I'll talk a little bit about where we are in the labor market nationally and what it likely means for Minnesota. The U.S. jobs recovery over the past six quarters of economic growth has been really lackluster at best. It's really been a jobless recovery, very similar to the recoveries we saw from the recessions in 1991 and 2001. It's really a recovery that only economists could love at this point. But we do see signs that the labor market is, at least in the private sector, starting to regain some momentum, and that momentum will build, I think, in 2011. We lost 8.4 million jobs nationally, peak to trough, during the recession from really the end of 2007 to the middle of 2009. We created about a million of those jobs last year, but it's really just a drop in the bucket. And I'll just say, historically, now 4 years since the beginning of the financial crisis and recession, at this point in time, in almost every other recovery, the U.S. economy would have already recreated all the jobs that were lost in the downturn. And here we are 4 years later just starting to recreate jobs. And so in that sense, we are in the mother of all jobless recoveries. So while I'm putting a positive spin on the economic outlook today, I want to remind the committee members of the job ahead of us. And I think it's still a little bit too early to declare mission accomplished in terms of a self-sustaining economic environment. So what is this? We are seeing signs of a broadening out in the labor market in terms of job growth. It started primarily in the manufacturing sector. We had the Cash for Clunkers program, which depleted auto inventories, and we started to see manufacturing growth there. We also saw a nice, strong recovery in global economies like China and India and other emerging markets that helped support export demand from some of our manufacturers in Minnesota, especially in transportation and electrical equipment. But it seems to be broadening out to services businesses, which is key because 80% of our jobs are in the services sector. And even in the construction side, which has been lagging in this recovery, we're seeing the drag from construction job losses slowly diminishing, and we think that will be even less of a drag in 2011. So we are seeing the broadening out of the recovery that we need to see to build a foundation for a self-sustaining recovery. As I noted in my opening remarks, initial jobless claims are now trending below 400,000 a weekly basis. And that's a good sign that layoffs are subsiding. We aren't seeing mass layoffs are the lowest we've seen in 5 or 6 years, and this is certainly a sign that we're gaining some momentum in the labor market. Yes, hiring Chair. Remains cautious at this point, but from the survey data we're looking at, we think we're going to see somewhat stronger job growth in the months ahead.
Mr. Anderson, just yes. A moment. Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, is there a way to factor in the people that actually just fell off of unemployment and never got a job? This is kind of based on people who are getting unemployment. Is there a way to factor in, or is there no way to know?
Well, we do track, the BLS tracks not only initial claims, but continuing claims, and they also track the people that are getting emergency benefits. And we are seeing improvement in almost all those indicators, not just the initial claims data, but also the number of people that are collecting continuing and emergency benefit claims. Now, some of that is some people may be leaving the labor force, basically exiting the labor force. It wouldn't be accounted as unemployed. But from what we can read in the BLS data, it's not a substantial number. So this decline in the unemployment benefits number looks to be a genuine improvement in labor market conditions rather than just something that happened with the unemployment benefits. And
please continue, Mr. Anderson.
Sure. So we still have a long ways to go on the unemployment. That will remain a huge national as well as a state issue. We still have what many economists would consider too much slack in the economy. One way to help solve our federal deficit and debt problems is to get more people back to work and starting to pay taxes again instead of drawing on emergency unemployment benefits. So we are starting to see signs that unemployment rate has peaked. Some of this improvement in the national unemployment rate is due to, as I mentioned, people exiting the labor force. So we got down to 9% U.S. unemployment, according to the official headline number. In January, we think some of that may have been seasonally related, so don't be surprised if that unemployment rate bounces up again in the months ahead. I would be pretty surprised if we ended 2011 with a rate much under 9%. You can see that the U6 measure of unemployment, which is a broader measure of unemployment, includes people that are working part-time for economic reasons or people that have actually given up looking for work, discouraged workers, because they've been looking for work for long and they haven't been able to find a job. That unemployment rate remains at around 16%. Not Great Depression levels, but certainly at unacceptably high levels. From a policymaking standpoint, and we still need to grow the economy for many several more years at the current rates just to get those rates back down to what we consider a fully employed economy. One of the good news stories over the past year has been the increase in household wealth. According to the Federal Reserve's flow of funds data, household net worth dropped by almost $17 trillion peak to trough in just a blink of economic time since the financial crisis began. About half of those wealth declines were due to housing wealth, and the other half was due to declines in stock wealth. Since the stock market has begun to recover, households have been able to rebuild some of that lost wealth. And while this data is a little lagged, we do have estimates through the first quarter of 2010 that we may have recreated about $10 trillion of that lost wealth. So households are in a better financial position than they were just a few years ago. We're not back to where we were in 2007. And almost all those gains are due to stock market increases rather than increases in housing wealth.
Mr. Anderson,
yes.
Just a moment. Question is, how much of that also increase in wealth is due to paying off personal debt, paying off corporate debt, that type of thing? How has that changed and affected that number?
It's a very good question, Mr. Chairman. I think a lot of that is due to the asset increases in asset prices. We have seen a decline in total debt. Among households, a lot of that coming from the mortgage side. But from what I can read in the Fed data, when I delve into the details, a lot of that due is to bank charge-offs of bad debt rather than households voluntarily paying down that debt. It is an improvement. It does improve the financial situation of all households just to erase some of that debt. But again, you probably read a lot in the papers about households becoming very frugal in their spending and have, you know, they've found religion and they're going to spend much more frugally going forward. We don't see a lot of evidence of that in the data. I think for the U.S. consumer, they tend to spend whatever they have in terms of income, and that really hasn't changed all that much over the past 2 years.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was also thinking about this particular slide and these numbers. So I just want to make sure I understand. So we were looking at about a $16.8 trillion drop in household net worth. How much of that do you think we've made up so far? What did you say that was?
Well, we only have data through the third quarter, and so officially we've only made up about $6 trillion of that $17 trillion.
Okay. Right.
But we have done estimates based on what the stock market performance has been for the fourth and mm-hmm. first quarter of this year and so far, and we think it's probably be closer to $10 trillion when we get the actual figures in for through the first quarter of.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Senator DeCrafe.
Thank you, Chairman Lilly. Mr. Anderson, you mentioned just briefly something about credit cards, and I want to could you respond a little bit about what's happening in the country based on I mean, you hear ads about, you know, if you owe so much in credit card debt, you can get it reduced. Are there charge-offs happening? Are there payoffs happening? I mean, payoffs, I'm sure there are. Are there people restructuring their loans to better handle them? Can you speak about that just a little bit? I have some concern about another crash happening somehow here with the credit card debt. And I'd like to hear you speak on that.
Well, Senator and Mr. Chairman. I think what I understand with the data is we are seeing, and this comes from the mortgage bank or the Federal Reserve data around all commercial banks. This isn't Wells Fargo specific, but we are seeing large declines both quarter on quarter and year on year in credit card delinquency rates, which is, you know, the earliest stages of, you know, it means people aren't making their credit card payments, the earliest stages of credit problems. Why is that? I don't think it's due to the fact that all of a sudden people are finding more new jobs and their incomes are growing. I think we have seen a tightening in credit around credit cards, and a lot of the data that I look at suggests that it's just a lot of the worst credit risks have had their either credit reduced or they're not using their credit cards as much. I think the data from Visa suggests that there's about 125 million fewer credit cards in this country than there were just 2 years ago. So it's not as easy to get issued a credit card as it once was just a few years ago. And because of that, we've seen an improvement in credit losses in the banking system. Along with that, of course, we've seen a contraction in consumer credit over the past year, and it's been a fairly steep contraction in consumer credit. And that's part of the reason why we've had such a lackluster recovery so far in consumer spending. The good news on that front is, at least the data we're getting from the Fed Senior Loan Officer Survey data, and from the Federal Reserve, is that we are seeing some growth right now, over the last couple months at least, in consumer credit, and some of that has been around credit cards. We did see, like I said, consumers return to the stores in the fourth quarter, and that appears some of that spending growth was put on credit cards, really for the first time since the financial crisis. I don't think we're close to another debt bubble that's about to burst on the consumer side because of the tightened lending standards and the fact that, you know, credit has contracted so much since the recovery started. So I think we're some consumer credit growth is probably warranted here, and it's certainly probably a good sign that the economy is getting back on track.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked a little bit about the tightening of credit for personal lines. Let's talk a little bit about business lines and what happened with the industry there. And I'll just start with a little story, a personal story. And I bank with Wells Fargo, and I've got a business line there. And they reduced my business line by 75%. And I called up and I said, geez, you know, I make my payment in full every month. Is there something that I'm not aware of? And they said, no, Mr. Howe, we didn't do it just to you. We did it to everybody. And I'm just, you know, at the most inopportune time where we need to help our businesses and try and spur growth and try and come out of this recession, It appears that the bank industry across the board wasn't very judicial on who could pay and who couldn't pay. It was just a flat line. I'm just wondering how those decisions get made and how they don't actually look at the person but just take their credit risk across the board and make that cut. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to that.
So, Senator Howell, you're not actually asking for an extension at this time?
I don't need an extension of the credit line. So, but you know, they cut it. Seriously, they cut it so much that I wouldn't be able to pay a utility bill. I mean, basically, in the businesses I run, I wouldn't have been able to pay a utility bill with that. I mean, it had someone not had the financial wherewithal, it was a nail in the coffin for many businesses, and I'm just troubled by that.
This is a significant issue. Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator, obviously, I'm an economist for Wells Fargo. I'm not the chief credit officer or even necessarily a risk manager for our bank. But what I do know and what we had was in this country was an asset bubble and a debt bubble that blew up and was inflated in 2005 and 2007. With the Great Recession, that debt bubble was pricked. Asset prices collapsed. I think there was probably, this is my own personal view, I think that there was probably an overextension of credit and the ease of gaining credit during the height of the bubble was probably greater than what was prudent. And so I don't think going back to the way credit was in 2007 would be the right policy choice to make or the right business decision to make from a bank. One thing that happened in this financial crisis and Great Recession was a lot of the businesses that we had lent that were lent to very aggressively, their finances really fell apart. And we're in the business of making loans at Wells Fargo, and we've been very active in doing so, expanding our mortgages over the past year, much greater than some of our competitors. And even we're seeing very good signs today of stronger business lending. And so to get at your business lending question, I do think terms are loosening from where they were a year ago. And we are starting to see more loan growth, especially in commercial industrial loans. And we mentioned that in our earnings release, the last earnings release at Wells Fargo, and certainly it shows up in the Fed's data around business lending. That doesn't mean we're going to go back to the way credit conditions were, 2 years ago.
Just a quick
Senator
follow,
Howell.
Mr. Chair. I understand that the rules, there was maybe too much credit out there. But I wanted you to speak to maybe the overreaction of not diligently looking at each creditor or debtor, but that there was just this blanket policy that we're going to reduce the extension of credit across the board, and there was no rationale given in my case, that made any sense. My personal lines were higher than my business line. I'm just wondering, what was the thought process over there, and was there an overreaction, and did that help heighten the recession a little bit, that it caused additional businesses that maybe could have survived? Because I truly think, we went way back to the point where the only people who could get credit were the people who didn't need credit. And I do agree. I think they're starting to loosen up a little bit. But my question goes back: was there an overreaction, or what was the thought process? And maybe you're not. Maybe you need to get some information to us about what was that thought process, and how did those cuts across the board come? Or in fact, was there cuts across the board, or was there more thought put into it?
Dr. Anderson,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Howe, I'm not privy to what the actual decision-making process was on that. I do know that as a bank, we track credit conditions on a geographical basis to some extent, and we look at credit conditions and financial conditions at a pretty granular level. So I would be surprised if there were across the board blanket decisions being made without looking at individual circumstances. But I'm not aware of that, and I will certainly go back to my institution and see if I can, you know, surface some more information for you, Senator Howell.
Dr. Anderson, I believe that a crucial part of that conversation is the fact that here in the Capitol in St. Paul and Washington, D.C., in capitals across the country, we have politicians talking to the bankers saying, please lend more. We can't create jobs without that relationship with our local banks. And yet you were faced with an environment where the regulators were telling you to improve your credit quality, to be more cautious on your lending. If your customers are not up to a certain standard, that you cannot lend to them anymore. So the environment that you were living in, that the banking industry was living in, was a very complex and disjointed industry. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Lilly. There's certainly some truth to that. I mean, at the highest levels of government, and I get to Washington twice a year and meet with the Federal Reserve and Council of Economic Advisors in Washington. And at the highest levels, there was a lot of anxiousness to have banks lend more but at the lower levels of the regulatory agencies, you're right, we were getting a lot of pressure to not make stupid loans, and you know, to keep our capital ratios high. We had this financial regulation bill that was recently passed in Washington. All these things designed to make our financial system safer, and probably are prudent things to do in the long term. But in the short term, there is some truth to the fact that it could delay or slow down the recovery in lending, in the aggressiveness that banks are going to be able to grow their lending going forward. The other thing we always mention is that part of this was also a demand problem. Yes, credit tightened on the supply side, probably prudently so, given the way conditions were prior to the financial crisis. But there was also a lack of demand for new loans. I'll just share with you an anecdotal piece of evidence that I heard when in among my travels at Wells Fargo. Speaking to a small business loan officer in Las Vegas, mentioning to me that, we're trying to make small business loans to all of our customers. We're pushing loan applications in all our small business customers. But very few are qualifying for the credit. Even they fill out the loan application because their financial situations were so impaired. And those that did qualify for the credits ended up not taking the loan. They didn't want the money because there was such a reluctance to borrow and to overextend themselves. And so there was really a little bit of a chicken and egg problem, and demand was certainly an issue and has been an issue around business loans. A lot of companies that have lines of credit open with the bank aren't utilizing them as much as we've seen in the past. And partly that's because of the slack in the economy, the lack of business investment over the past 2 years. There just hasn't been a need to deploy that capital and credit.
One more question from Senator DeCrieff, and then we'll move back into the sure conversation. Senator.
Thank you, Chairman Lilly. This has to go – this question is in regards somewhat to what Senator Howe asked and somewhat to what Senator Lilly asked. But there was a government bailout of the banks that took place. And if my memory serves me, I think Wells Fargo was a recipient in part of that. And can you speak about how that came into play and how that because in the news, we were hearing that the governments or the banks had this money now, and rather than giving more loans, they were using it to buy other banks, which was counterproductive, I think, to what the intent was. Can you speak to that somewhat and help this committee understand how that all ties together?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think what you're referring to is the TARP funding that the banks received at the height of the financial crisis. I'll just say that our Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke has noted that some of our largest financial institutions were basically on the edge of the abyss, the financial abyss, in terms of, I think he said 12 of the 13 largest financial institutions were near collapse at the height of the financial crisis. So we were very close to that edge, and the whole purpose of the TARP money was to stabilize the banks so that we didn't go into a situation like we had during the 1930s when our banks collapsed and we had no financial system in place. So what I think the TARP funding was designed to do, and I think was quite successful in doing, was allowing our financial system to remain intact. And you can see that the financial regulation bill that was recently passed is designed to improve that system going forward. But I think the TARP money was designed to stabilize the banks when, at a time when the private sector wasn't willing to help the banks at all. I mean, there is, it, just as during economic crises, when banks pull back in lending, when you think that businesses most need the loans, same thing happens in our financial markets, especially the bond and stock markets. And what the TARP money allowed the banks to do is to go back into the credit markets and actually raise capital, both stock and bond capital. And that certainly is what happened right after the TARP was funded. And that really saved our financial aid and probably kept us from seeing unemployment rates in this country moving much higher than they ended up going, and certainly shortening the span of the recession overall. Now, you can say, you know, whether some of that money was waste or not, I have no evidence of that, no information around that. But I do think from an economist's perspective, I think it was successful in stabilizing our financial system and actually reduced the economic and financial pain that will hit average Americans because of what just happened.
All right. Mr. Anderson, Dr. Anderson, sure. Please continue.
Sure. Because of the depth of the recession, the high unemployment, the loss of household wealth, consumers still don't feel like we're in an economic recovery. That's why I say this is an economic recovery that only economists could love at this point. If you look at consumer confidence, this comes from the Conference Board, is still near recessionary levels and very near and even lower than what we saw coming out of the 2001 recession. Yet, consumer spending has accelerated, and retail sales are now trending at around a 7% growth rate year over year. So why the difference between what consumers are saying and what they're actually doing? And I think the answer comes from what's happening with incomes. As I mentioned, consumers might say they're saving more, they're not going to spend, or they're cautious about their spending, but we found through our economic research that a much better indicator of what consumers are going to do is what's happening with their income and their income growth. And on that front, the news has been significantly better. Because of the growing economy, personal incomes are growing at almost a 4% pace over the past 3 months on an annualized basis. That's the lifeblood. That's the ammunition that's needed to keep the consumers spending at a decent pace, and there's no real sign of that fading. I will point out that some of this personal income growth is due to government support. And so I don't want to say that the government, the fiscal stimulus that has been put in place has been isn't being utilized. I think if you factor out transfer payments here, almost 2 percentage points of that income growth is coming from government transfers. So that is helping to boost consumer and business spending. I guess our most pessimistic part of our presentation centers around the housing market, and that was certainly an issue not only for our job in terms of our job losses, but also certainly led to and facilitated the tight credit conditions in the banking system. Around the housing front, we really are bouncing along the bottom in terms of building activity. Nationally, home building dropped by over 85% peak to trough. One thing you'll notice in my slide here is that over the past year, through April of 2010, we had more than a 30% increase in building activity. Almost all that building activity evaporated once the first-time home buyer credit disappeared. And it's almost barely visible on this slide. So You know, we're still at near record low levels in terms of home building. We do expect a little bit more activity in 2011 than we saw last year. But again, it was probably still going to be the third worst year ever for home builders since we've been collecting data in the post-war period. Housing demand remains very, very weak. We did have a buildup in existing and pending home sales along the lines of the home buyer tax credit. As we saw a run-up to the expiration of those tax credits, we did see a run-up in housing demand around those dates. But you can see that after the tax credit expired in April of 2010, it's been basically the mirror image, and we've seen a big decline in home sales for much of last year. Now, I think we're stabilizing at very, very low levels today in terms of housing demand, but there's no real sign that housing demand is picking up anytime soon. And certainly a rise in mortgage rates or interest rates going forward could temper any sort of gains we have on the demand side. So when I look at the national housing market, and certainly this has implications for the Minnesota housing market as well, I still see issues around housing supply. If you look at the visible inventory of homes in the economy, we still have about 3.5 million homes, existing homes, on the market today, according to the Realtors Association. That is down from the peaks we had in 2008 and 2009 of around 4.5 million units. But there's also a shadow supply of housing out there related to the potential houses that are going to come on the market due to distressed sales. And on that front, I still see some supply issues around the fact that we still have way too many households not making their mortgage payments. If you look at the national data from the Mortgage Bankers Association around delinquency and foreclosure rates, both for the United States and Minnesota, you can see that compared to historical averages, we still have almost 14% of all mortgage holders not making their mortgage payments nationally. They're either in delinquent or they're in foreclosure. For the state of Minnesota, the numbers are quite a bit better than the national averages at just over 9%, but still well above anything we've seen over the past four or five recessions. This is problematic because we know that a couple of variables are very important in determining whether someone defaults on their mortgage or not and has to put their home up for sale. One, of course, is the unemployment rate. The higher the unemployment rate in the region, of course, the more financial distress that causes and the more likely a mortgage holder is likely to default. But we also know that the more homeowners that are underwater on the mortgage also can lead to higher delinquency and foreclosure rates. So the fact that we've still have just started on that process of bringing down those delinquency rates, foreclosures have actually come up a little bit in parts of the country, that we're still a long ways from signaling the all clear on this, and certainly this could put further downward pressure on home values. And so when I look at the housing market overall, there's various home price metrics that people look at. One of the ones that we track is the Case-Shiller Index, and we do forecast at least around a 5% decline over the next 12 months in national home prices, median home prices. And in some markets, some of the biggest markets in the country, we could see declines in some metro areas of between 5% and 10%. When I look at we don't have futures data around the Minneapolis market or Twin Cities market, but we are estimating at least a 5% decline in Twin Cities home values in 2011. It could be a little bit more than that, depending on the timing of foreclosures and distressed sales. So that is certainly going to be a negative for getting us through this credit crisis, at least around the mortgage market, and also around the ability for consumers to get back to more normal rates of spending. So we are still predicting a solid economic growth environment, even with these continuing problems centered around housing and some of the credit issues that surround that.
Mr. Anderson.
Yes.
Just one moment. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, before we leave the real estate market, I'm wondering, can you speak a little bit about the commercial real estate market? It I'm not an expert in that area, but it's a little concerning. I mean, it seems, and it seems that the time period between when the height of the commercial real estate market was and when most of those loans are going to be coming up, because, you know, maybe they're a 7-year loan amortized over 25 years and they're coming up for renewal, the value of those commercial real estate properties are quite depressed. And I'm just concerned about how banks are going to be able to handle that and what kind of flexibility you have with performing loans. Real estate, commercial real estate owners that have had performing loans have always paid their mortgage on time. But now the loan comes up for renewal, you know, and suddenly their value is underwater, yet it's a performing loan. What do you anticipate that happening, and what type of flexibility do the banks have in that regard?
Dr. Anderson.
Yes, Chairman Lilly and Senator Nelson. There's certainly continuing issues around commercial real estate. As you noted, commercial real estate values are quite depressed. In many markets, commercial real estate values have dropped at least 30%. In some markets, as much as 50% from where they were 2 years ago. What I have seen is that most of the banks have been extending those mortgages when they come up for renewal, as long as the mortgage holders are making their payments, and even though they may be underwater. One thing we are seeing is some signs of improvement in commercial real estate values. In some of the metro areas that we cover, we are seeing commercial estate values recovering from some of those record low levels, certainly in prime locations. That doesn't mean there isn't going to be some distress there that are going to that is going to cause some credit losses and some mortgage problems for some commercial real estate owners. But it's not a huge issue for our outlook for the financial system or the banking system or the U.S. economy. It's a much smaller component of our overall loan portfolios, among larger banks at least. While this certainly could prolong the tightness in overall credit conditions, especially in commercial real estate, I think that, you know, from an economic and financial standpoint, it'll be less of an event than what we just went through on the residential side. The problem with residential real estate, it hit the U.S. consumer, which is 70% of our economy. It was the largest asset that households held. Commercial real estate investors tend to be more deeper pocketed individuals. For the most part, they tend to be more sophisticated investors, and they're able to weather declines in asset values a little bit better than what made the average homeowner was able to do. That doesn't mean there's going to be some banks that aren't going to have problems. Some of the community banks and smaller banks have been overexposed to commercial real estate, and that has caused some tightness in credit to linger in some of those institutions, at least from the data that I can see. But it doesn't seem to be as big of an issue for our economic outlook as what we just went through.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson, yes.
Thank you. And so my concern is the small business owners, not the large agencies, but the small business owners who have entered this market at a time where commercial real estate was an all-time high. Now they've got to refinance their loans. And I just to clarify, do the banks have the ability then to continue those loans as long as they're performing loans? I was concerned that some of the new federal regulation that had come down would preclude or not allow banks who would like to renew those loans, those performing loans, and yet the asset value is below value of the loan, from doing that. Do banks have the ability to renew those loans for performing loans that are underwater?
Dr. Anderson.
Senator Nelson, I am not aware of anything that would preclude banks from doing that, but I will check with my institution and get back to you with a more specific answer.
Thank you. I would like that answer.
Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Chairman Lilly. Mr. Anderson, I have a question. Going back to the home loan default rate, I've been hearing some reports of homeowners who have the ability to pay, who have had their homes paid up. They owe a fair amount on their homes yet. The values have dropped to a point where they feel that they can go buy another house in the neighborhood, and they actually have done so, bought a similar house for quite a bit less money, and walked away from a loan and dropped it off, the keys off at the bank, and said it's yours.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak on that just a little bit? Because I mean, to me, who believes that a handshake should be worth something yet, and here somebody made a good faith deal and left the bank essentially holding the bag. I have a special place for some people like that. But can you speak on that, on how the banks handle such a thing, are you seeing that happen in large degree?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, that's a very good question. Yes, we are seeing signs of that in some markets. One thing that I often say, this financial crisis was a perfect storm in many ways. And one thing that troubled me early in this financial crisis was the fact that we were forecasting at least 30% declines in national home values, fully aware that many homeowners were going to be underwater on their mortgages by perhaps hundreds of thousands of dollars, and realizing that these people are going to likely be underwater on their mortgages for perhaps a decade or so. And realizing that, what's to stop people from handing in their, rather than, the stigma associated with that perhaps hits to their credit rating or whatever, what's to stop them from defaulting and deciding to default, even though they might be able to make those payments. And the Fed's done some interesting research around that issue. Certainly we have seen in those markets where home values have dropped the most and people are underwater the most, we are seeing more signs of strategic defaulting there. We also have understand there's a learning that goes on. In other words, if you know somebody who's strategically defaulted on your mortgage, you're more likely to strategically default on your mortgage as well. So the stigma seems to disappear in some cases in some of those marketplaces. So it is a huge issue. And as you know, there are very many metro areas, including here in the Twin Cities, where we're still facing a lot of those issues. And that's part of the reason why the housing market is having such troubles recovering from this onslaught of what we call distressed sales or distressed properties. According to Zillow, they just did a study recently, came out last week, that around 40% of mortgage holders in the Twin Cities are underwater on their mortgage. In other words, they have negative equity in their homes. So that is an issue. And some other markets, like in Phoenix and Las Vegas, for example, those numbers are between 70 and 80% of mortgage holders. So it's still an issue in many parts of the country.
All right, Senator Kielash, and then let's move on again to the
It kind of relates to the mortgage thing that he's been talking about. And that is when you broke down, when you look at the numbers of how the $10 trillion is coming back into the economy, or the assets are increasing over the last few months. I'm just wondering if you could break it down into income quartile, so that is one of the problems is those folks on the lower end of the income level, if they haven't seen their incomes raise, they're going to have more likely to have foreclosures. And can you break that down a bit as to who's actually gaining that extra asset?
Well, the government doesn't track that, at least not on a timely basis. But I can speak to that to some extent. One thing we did see, and this comes from proprietary data that I've seen that comes from Moody Analytics, is that and they do income by quartile, by income bracket. And one thing that we saw was when this financial crisis started in end of 2007, early 2008, most homeowners, most income quartiles were spending more than they had income. Their savings rate were negative, and people were drawing on their home equity to boost their spending to some extent. But for the high income brackets, their savings rates were actually going up and were quite high. What happened in 2009 was once stock market value stabilized, those high income bracket households started to spend again. And they went back to, it was almost like a light switch going off. They went from 26% savings rate, this is down to negative savings rates at the top income bracket. And that's been a big piece of why consumer spending has been growing so strongly. If you look at the data, that top income bracket is responsible for about 40% of overall consumer spending. So it's a huge factor overall. The rest of the households are being left behind to some extent. I mean, the incomes, their savings rates have gone up throughout the crisis and continue to be high. They are spending less, and when they do spend, they're spending more on the necessities like gasoline, food, and shelter. And they're not splurging as much as the others. Now, we are seeing even some of those households have been able to take advantage. If they're not underwater in the mortgage, they've been able to refinance at lower rates. The Fed's been very active in trying to keep mortgage rates low through their quantitative easing programs. That's actually allowed the debt service burden from a lot of households to decline back to where they were in 2000 overall. So there are households that have been able to take advantage of the lower interest rates to refinance and to consolidate their credit into a more sustainable and affordable level of debt.
Just to follow up,
Senator Keeley.
Is there a breakdown in foreclosures based on income value? In other words, is there a higher percentage in middle income or lower income? And usually lower income has less home ownership, so I'm not sure where that goes. I wonder if you've got just
Well, we can look at inventories of housing by value of household, value of house, and we do know that, you know, those inventories have gone up a lot for the lower price properties. There's always obviously big discounting that goes on as well when the banks do that. But it has seems to have hit the lower income thresholds higher more than some of the upper income brackets. Though we do have big inventories now, even at the upper end, that we are seeing more defaults. Just over the past year, we've seen more defaults happening in higher-income households, primarily due to the increase in the unemployment rate. It wasn't, you know, at first the crisis was mainly among people that took out more debt than they could afford, that took out risky types of loan products. That shifted to people that took out 30-year fixed-rate mortgages that were tended to be higher-income households, but they were hit by a loss of job. Or health issue.
Thank you.
Dr. Anderson, thank you. And, sure. And I just remind the committee members that we've asked some great questions. I've not been around an economist that has created so many good questions out of a group of people, and we just want to make sure that we reserve time later on in the presentation. There's some good data to come on Minnesota jobs and the future of job growth in Minnesota.
Right.
So, Dr. Anderson, please continue.
Thank you. So we've talked about some of the issues around the consumer and housing and credit. But we are seeing some real signs of improvement in other areas of our economy that we think will allow the economy to continue to gain momentum in 2011. The Conference Board does an leading economic indicator index that tends to be a very good forecaster of the economy 6 months ahead. And that data is suggesting that financial conditions have improved to an extent over the past couple months that we will see stronger growth than what we were anticipating 6 months ago over the summer doldrums. And so we are seeing a reacceleration of the growth. You know, stock price increase is part of that, but we're also seeing declines in jobless claims, new order flows to manufacturers, and all these things suggest a stronger environment nationally in the first half of 2011. The other thing that gives us some hope that we'll be able to override some of the issues around the consumer and the housing market, as well as perhaps the drag we're going to see from state and local government budget cuts, is the fact that corporate profits have come back so strongly since the depth of the Great Recession. One thing we are seeing in the data, if you look at corporate profits nationally after tax, as a share of the economy, which is really a profit margin type of a measure. Corporate profits now exceed where they were in 2007 before the crisis hit, and they've recovered a lot faster than they did coming out of the 2001 recession. So we do know from past economic cycles that stronger corporate profits do lead to more job and business spending growth in the future. And the delay has been a little bit stronger and a little bit longer than what we've seen in past cycles, but the economic laws haven't been repealed yet, and we do see that, I think that we'll see more of those positive dynamics playing a role in 2011 than what we saw perhaps over the past year. Businesses have also adjusted to this new economic normal for the most part. Businesses have been very aggressive at cutting costs and cutting inventories and have really right-sized their businesses for the new level of sales growth. Business inventory sales ratios are still at pretty low levels, even below where they were when the recession started. So there's no real evidence that businesses are about to start cutting, making mass layoffs again or cutting inventories aggressively going forward, unless we had another shock to the economy in terms of a big decline in consumer demand, or something perhaps coming from abroad rather than here in the United States. But at least right now, it looks like we have the ammunition we need for a sustainable recovery. The other positive area of the economy that we are focusing on is around business spending and investment. Businesses were very reluctant to spend throughout the last expansion. We did have strong business spending leading up to the millennium change in 2000. Remember those days when people were worried about airplanes crashing into the water and all of our computers stopping to function? So there was a lot of spending around equipment and software prior to that. And really, businesses have been holding off on their spending really for much of the last decade. So there is a huge amount of pent-up demand there, and we are seeing double-digit growth rates right now on equipment and software spending. It's come down a little bit from where we were just a couple quarters ago, but we are still forecasting double-digit growth in 2011, which will allow us to survive even a housing market that kind of bounces along the bottom for at least another year. So when I look at the overall national picture, our view on the economy has brightened considerably since December, partly because of the stronger tone in the economic data, but also what happened with the Obama compromise in the extension of the tax cuts and some of the other payroll tax reductions that we think will help boost consumer spending at a stronger growth pace. We do think we're growing at around a 3.5% pace over the next couple of quarters. Year over year, we'll probably grow 3.3% in 2011, which is going to be up from around 2.9% in 2011. So it certainly is going to be a stronger environment going forward. Let me transition now to what that likely means for Minnesota's economy and economic outlook. You know, Minnesota actually got off to a pretty fast start in this economic recovery. In fact, job growth accelerated in Minnesota early in 2010. That job growth performance did tail off noticeably, particularly in the last 2 months of the year. You know, payrolls declined 0.1% in November. They were down 0.8% in December. But I do want to point out a longer time horizon to give you a sense of where Minnesota has been over the past 10 to 15 years in terms of its economic performance. And I don't want to dwell just on the past couple of months. I do think Minnesota's economic recovery remains intact. Indeed, with this national view of a strengthening economic growth environment for the nation in the first couple quarters of the year, that will translate to somewhat stronger job trends here in the state of Minnesota as the new year develops. But I think when you look at Minnesota over a longer-term period, you know, Minnesota's economic performance, at least in terms of job creation, has been pretty much in line with the national averages. In fact, if you go all the way back to 96, Minnesota's employment growth has grown about 8.6%, while the nation's employment has grown 8.5%. You can't get much closer than that over a 15-year period. So, the composition of that growth has been somewhat different. Minnesota's job performance did lag between 2005 and 2008 at the height of the financial bubble. And that's probably a good thing because I think growth was goosed a lot by what was happening in the housing markets, the fact that Minnesota didn't participate as much in that bubble as some other markets is a positive. Again, we've given up some of that improvement you know, over the last couple of months, we have seen a pretty big, strong increase in Minnesota job performance early in 2010, but that has been given up over the past couple months. When I look at it regionally around the state, one thing we do notice in the data is, you know, a lot of this job creation we had in Minnesota was centered around manufacturing activity. And in fact, in 2010, Minnesota manufacturing was up at a 3.6% pace. In 20, that's three times the national average in terms of the pickup in manufacturing employment. And that did lead to somewhat stronger performance in several metro areas around the state, particularly in Duluth. And in Rochester, we saw outperformance in manufacturing and service businesses. The state overall has trended around 1% over the past year in terms of payroll growth. The Twin Cities, Mankato, somewhat underperforming the state average, but all kind of centered around that 1% growth rate. You'll notice St. Cloud stands out as one metro area that's underperformed and actually lost jobs year over year in 2010. What's really driving that is St. Cloud did not have the manufacturing recovery that happened in other parts of the state. So their manufacturing gains were very, very weak compared to the other parts of the state. But they also saw more weakness in construction, government, and professional business services. And so it really does stand out as compared to the other parts of the other regions of the state. When I look at it by industry, we did see a pretty decent jobs recovery, again, over the past year, and we think we can build on that in 2011 as we see somewhat better private sector job growth spreading not only from the manufacturing sector but also spilling over more into the services type of businesses. Leisure and hospitality, education, and healthcare are going to be among the top performers, and we're all going to see more participation in retail trade as well, as consumers pick up and more small businesses participate in this economic recovery. We do still see drags on employment coming primarily from government and perhaps to some extent from construction and financial services, but the drag should continue to dissipate as the economy continues to recover and we see somewhat stronger home building activity centered primarily around multifamily housing. So when we look at the Minnesota job picture for 2011, we are seeing a marked improvement in job performance. We are currently forecasting employment growth in Minnesota of 1.5% in 2011. That will be up from what we had over the past 12 months of around 1% growth. You can see year over year we were basically flat for 2010. But we, you know, this is certainly some of the best performance we've seen in several years in the state of Minnesota, and will rival the rates of growth we had in 2005, which was some of the peak growth rates we had in the state of Minnesota. There is some truth to the fact that the deeper you fall, the faster you recover, and that's part of what's driving some of these growth numbers. Again, we do expect manufacturing to continue to lead the state in overall expansion in jobs, and primarily due to the strength of export activity. You know, the state's own data suggests that we had strong improvements in machinery, transportation, electrical equipment exports, rose at almost a 30% pace over the first three quarters of 2010. A lot of that was due to the acceleration in global growth. We saw in 2010 our exports to Asia were up 25% in the state of Minnesota. Our exports to Canada, China, Germany, all those states certainly led the way. But we also saw very strong export activity from Minnesota, exports to countries like Brazil and Chile that are real new markets for the state of Minnesota and certainly have the potential to be big markets in the future as those emerging markets develop into emerging middle-class economies. Their wealth is built up, and they will be bigger buyers of our exports going forward. So we still see solid export activity in 2011 for Minnesota manufacturers. In fact, a recent survey put out by the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota suggests that more than 50% of manufacturing companies are expected to grow orders in production in 2011. 47% of the manufacturers are boosting productivity in the state of Minnesota, and about a third of manufacturers are expecting to increase employment and capital spending in 2011, which are much improved from what we saw from the survey data just 6 months ago. On the unemployment rate, we have seen Minnesota's unemployment rate peak at a much lower level than what we saw nationally, peaked at just over 8%, and we saw that rate come down to around 6.8% in June of 2010. That was centered around the strength in household employment that we had around that period of time, but also the fact that our labor force did contract over the past 12 months as labor force participation did decline. That's holding down our unemployment rate a little bit more than it would otherwise be if all those people continued to look for jobs. I wouldn't be surprised if that unemployment rate rises a little bit over the next couple of months for the state of Minnesota. It's already gone up from 6.7 to 7% as we saw job growth weaken in the last couple of months of the year, and we certainly could see that creep above 7% over the next couple of months. Part of that will be due to people coming back into the labor force as they see more job creation. We do know that people will re-enter the labor force looking for work, and that will keep our unemployment rate at a relatively elevated level, at least for another year, before we start to see more of the impacts from that stronger job growth leading to bigger improvements in the unemployment rate. So when I look at Minnesota's unemployment rate for 2011, I don't expect it'll get below 6%, and it certainly could remain above 6.5% for some time here until we get more momentum on the jobs front. So it's probably another 2 or 3 years before we get the Minnesota unemployment rate back down to the 4% level that we've become accustomed to as a fully employed Minnesota economy. I think we still have several years of work to do on that front. One thing that troubles me a little bit, and I think will pose a potential problem for Minnesota's long-term economic growth. I've spent a lot of time today speaking about some of the short-term trends around the Minnesota economy, but I do want to focus on some of the longer-term issues, and one of them does center around Minnesota's population demographic trends. We do know that population growth does set the economic speed limit for regional economies around the country. The faster your population growth and immigration, it does equal to more domestic demand for things like retail, consumer services, healthcare, and even housing. So the fact that population growth could be slowing down, immigration growth could be slowing down, that does pose a long-term economic problem for the state of Minnesota. I'll say over the past 10 years, Minnesota's performance has been actually quite good. Over the past 10 years, Minnesota's population growth has been just under the U.S. average at 0.8%, somewhat above average for the Midwest and above many of our neighbors except for South Dakota. And that has been certainly a net positive for Minnesota's economy over the past 10 years. But when you look closer inspection of the population trends, you'll notice a significant break in population activity really centered around the 2001 recession was really the turning point. We had population growth in the late 90s of over 1%. And then after the 2001 recession, population growth slowed and really didn't recover all that much during the last expansion. Part of the problems around our housing market was that home builders went back to building houses again in the state of Minnesota like it was the late 1990s, and we never did have the in-migration that we had in the late 1990s. And that led to a bit of an oversupply problem around housing at the time when the financial crisis was really starting to pick up some pace. So we do see a different environment right now for people moving into the state of Minnesota. Part of that is related to Minnesota still isn't quite as competitive on business costs as they once were. The cost of living is I wouldn't say out of whack with the national average, but certainly isn't low by Midwestern standards. And we're getting more competition, quite frankly, from our regional neighbors, states like North and South Dakota. You're not seeing as many people moving in from those states because their economies there are performing much better. Agricultural prices have improved. Commodity prices have been very strong. They didn't have the house bubble that we had in the Twin Cities as much. And for all those reasons, we're not seeing as many people move into the state as we once did maybe 10 years ago, and we don't really see any change in that over the next couple of years at least. So that does lower the speed limit on economic growth no matter what we do in other areas. If you don't have the 20,000 to 30,000 people moving into the state that we had before, that it gets a lot harder to outperform the nation. Around the housing market, and then I'll open it up for some more questions and comments. We have not been able to avoid the housing downturn that hit nationally. In fact, some of the credit problems and foreclosure issues here in the Twin Cities and the state have been on par with some of those bubble states we've seen in places like Florida and California and in Nevada. It was actually quite a bit more severe than what I had imagined at the outset of the crisis, because traditionally Midwestern states tend to avoid a lot of those sorts of boom and bust periods, but we certainly got caught in it to some extent this time around. Twin Cities home values have dropped about 30% from the 2006 peaks. One thing we did notice, that home values did peak earlier in the Twin Cities than they did nationally, so we did see weakness in home values starting earlier than what we saw nationally. This comes from the Case-Shiller Index. You can see that in the Twin Cities, at least, home values started to decline. Price increases started to decline in 2004. A lot of that was due to the oversupply issues I think we had among some of the builders that went back to building early in the expansion, and we just didn't see the housing demand develop to the extent that home builders envisioned. And by 2006, we were starting to see home price declines in the Twin Cities, and those home price declines have rivaled those that we've seen at the national level. Since the recovery has started, we did see a nice rebound in Twin Cities home values. At one point, before the home buyer tax credit expired, Twin Cities home values were up 10% from their lows over the Great Recession cycle. Again, with the weakness that we've seen creep back into the housing market, all those gains have been given up, and we're starting to see price declines once again reemerging in the Twin Cities that are more severe than what we're seeing nationally. One thing that I think is playing a role is the level of distressed sales. As I mentioned, we still have about 40% of mortgage holders in the Twin Cities that are underwater on their mortgages, and we are seeing a very high level of distressed sales activity still in the Twin Cities market. Almost 40% of all sales in 2010 were distressed sales, and then that's putting downward pressure on median home values more in the Twin Cities than we're seeing in some other parts of the Midwest, and we don't see any reason why that's going to change anytime soon. When you look at sales activity by home value, you certainly see a lot of weakness in housing demand still in the lower-priced properties. Anything below $500,000 and below, we're seeing net sales declines. We are seeing sales gains in the higher-income properties, interestingly, in the $500,000 to million-dollar category over the past year. But before you get too excited about that, I think part of the sales activity we're seeing there is because of that inventories in those areas are so high that there's a lot of discounting going on right now in those higher-priced properties. So you're really getting pressure at both ends of the housing market in the Twin Cities. At the low end, because of distressed sales, you're seeing price declines there. But also at the high end, because inventories, month supply of inventory for million-dollar properties is now over 22 months of inventory in the Twin Cities. And so you're seeing much more discounting at those higher price points that are also pushing down the median. So you're getting kind of a barbell effect of price pressures on both sides. Overall, there's still too much supply in the Twin Cities market. A normal housing market has 4 to 5 months of inventory. I wouldn't say we're way above. We're still below the peaks we've seen in this downturn. But again, this is enough downward pressure still on home values that we could see, like I said, another 5 to 10% decline in existing home prices, median home prices over the coming year in the Twin Cities. So my final slide is around home building. Home building is down about 70% from the peaks in the Twin Cities, somewhat below the declines we've seen nationally. We are seeing some pickup in building activity from the lows we saw in 2009. A lot of that building activity is primarily coming from the multifamily space. Building permits are running about 20% above euro levels in multifamily. And one thing we're seeing around that is because of the high level of distress sales, we are seeing more renter demand. Rents are going up. Apartments, a lot of apartments haven't been built over the past couple of years because of the financial crisis. And so we are seeing builders starting to build more rentals in apartments, and that is showing up in the permitting activity. And that will lead to somewhat better overall building activity in 2011 than what we've seen over the past couple of years. Still going to be the third worst year ever, though, probably for home builders, and probably still below the level of activity we saw in 2007. So I guess with that, I will close and open up for any questions you might have on the committee. In short, I am cautiously optimistic about the U.S. and Minnesota's economy's ability to generate more private sector jobs in 2011 than we saw in 2010. I think we'll see more participation among service businesses and small businesses in terms of job growth in the coming year than what we've seen over the past 12 months. The drag from housing is still going to be very much visible. We're still going to see drags at state and local government level from potential expenditure cuts there. And construction still is a problem. We've lost 50,000 construction jobs in the state of Minnesota since this recession started. It was down 38% peak to trough, and we still aren't generating any jobs in that sector. On the government side, we've lost 12,500 jobs in overall government employment over the past 12 months, and is down 3% from the peaks. That's going to continue to be a drag. Even in manufacturing, that bright spot in our economy where we've seen 3.5% increase in employment, we're still down. We still dropped more than 100,000 jobs in manufacturing in the state of Minnesota. We declined 27% peak to trough. So this recovery we're seeing in manufacturing is still just a drop in the bucket from what we've lost over the past 4 years throughout this financial crisis and Great Recession. So I do think a foundation is being laid for sustainable economic growth. I do think we're setting ourselves up for a period in 2012 where at least some of the national policy stimulus that's been put in place over the past 4 years will be able to start being scaled back. I'm hopeful that we'll start to see similar expenditure cuts in cuts at the state and local levels to right-size our government for this new economic normal. We've had the adjustment in the private sector. We're still working through the adjustments in the government sector, and I think that's where we're at right now in this recovery. So I think the foundations are being laid for sustainable economic growth, but there's still a long way to go. I'll turn it back over to you, Chairman.
All right. Dr. Anderson, thank you very much. And I think we've all heard some cheering and some enthusiasm from the rotunda. I believe that we're all talking about jobs and creating jobs out there, and perhaps they're all cheering for you. I'm not sure. But thank you for joining us today. I did have a question regarding, I believe it was slide 17, about corporate profits.
Yeah.
And my question surrounds, all right, corporate profits are increasing.
Mm-hmm.
Where are those profits? Are they large cap, small cap, mid cap? Are they the local businesses? We've had many conversations about an improvement on Wall Street, but what's happening with Main Street? Many of us, I think, would feel that, gosh, we're not seeing that. So help us understand where those profits are coming from and what they mean.
Well, I think over the past year, a lot of that corporate profit growth has come from larger businesses and those that are related to the stronger export activity and manufacturing activity that we've seen. It's been slower to come to some services business and smaller businesses. But even there, we do a survey along with the Gallup organization every quarter of our small business customers. And over the past two quarters, we've seen the biggest improvement in small business optimism than we've ever seen since we've been doing this survey in 2003. This is very similar to the recovery we saw in small business optimism around 2004, 2005, at the time when the U.S. economy did pick up some very decent momentum. So I think even smaller businesses are starting to see an improvement in their top-line growth, their revenues, and sales activity. And that's primarily centered around stronger activity coming from the U.S. consumer. So we are seeing that profit growth happen, and at this point, businesses have been pretty reluctant to deploy those profits. A lot of businesses have been using this profit growth to pay down debts, to refinance debts. They've used it to squirrel it away in just terms of a cash hoard because of the uncertainties around the viability of this economic recovery, but also what I hear anecdotally, at least, and we also see this showing up somewhat in our survey results, is reluctance around, you know, the cost of hiring. The healthcare bill was certainly an uncertainty that hit businesses last year that kept them from holding back in terms of hiring permanently. What we did see is businesses hiring temporary jobs, and we do think that's going to lead to more permanent hiring in 2011. But we saw more temporary hiring by businesses than we've ever seen coming out of a recession. Part of that was due to uncertainties around regulation, taxes, and health care costs around hiring a permanent worker. I think some of those uncertainties were removed after the midterm elections, the extension of the Bush tax cuts, and that's allowed for more businesses, I think, on the margin to green light some of their hiring and spending plans in the coming year. And I think that's what we're picking up in our survey results.
Very good. Senator Daley.
Dr. Anderson, a few years ago, there were some who predicted that there was going to be a huge collapse in the real estate market. There are now some who are saying that government at the federal level, and especially the state levels as well, are living beyond their means, and it's the next crisis. As you take out your crystal ball, your macro view of the world, do you agree or disagree with that view, and more importantly, why?
Good question, Senator and Mr. Chairman. I think those are the issues before us. I think we've had this shrinkage and right-sizing of our private sector economy because of the Great Recession and financial crisis. We haven't yet done that with our government, either at the federal level or at the state level. So I do think there needs to be a right-sizing of, and this is my own personal view, not the views of Wells Fargo, there needs to be a right-sizing of government at the federal or state levels, especially given, and I think many, I'm not the only economist out there talking about some of these issues, given the concerns I have about our long-term fiscal health, especially at the national level. These demographic trends that I talked about, you know, the slowing of the population growth, the aging of our population, these are issues that I've been worried about since my time at the International Monetary Fund in the early 90s. These are certainly not new issues for economists. I mean, Greenspan used to talk about Social Security 30 years ago and the coming issues around that. These are solvable issues. They're not politically popular in terms of taking the tough economic and financial medicine that's needed. But I do think it's needed for our long-term economic health. And I think any economist will tell you the sooner we address these fiscal issues, the better and the less economic and financial pain there will be down the road. The longer we delay these issues, the bigger the problem becomes and the more painful the cuts will have to be when the time comes. You know, it's very easy to wait for a crisis to hit before you make these choices. And I certainly would urge members of this committee and policymakers in general to not wait for the crisis this time. The bond market has a way of disciplining governments, and we're seeing that developing today in countries like Greece and Ireland and Portugal and Spain. I think we've got some room to get these issues under control, but I do think we should rely more on expenditure cuts than on revenue increases at this point because of the shock that's hit our private sector. We really need to downsize the government to match our new leaner and meaner private sector economy.
All right. I do have questions from Senators Torres Ray, Senator Nelson, and Senator Kelash. We only have a couple minutes left, so we'll get as far as we can with those, and the rest of us can ask questions perhaps after we are done with the meeting. So, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, it's good to have the opportunity to ask an economist a question that we're asking ourselves right now, which is the tax cuts for corporate industries. And so as I hear your presentation and hear, you know, that corporate profits for, you know, large companies are pretty good, and listen to the news about the high-end luxury retail profits. Tiffany had the best 5 years in their, you know, profits ever. And lots of Delta reported, you know, quite substantial profits. So corporates are, you know, corporate industry is doing quite well. Profits are, you stated that. They're getting money. But an argument that we are contemplating here in terms of public policy is that we now have to cut taxes to them so that they bring jobs, because they create jobs. And some of us are trying to kind of really look at the link. Mm-hmm. Is it true? Is it that we, you know, they're making money and now we have to cut taxes because they're going to bring jobs to our region? As an economist, is that correct?
Senator, this is, again, my own personal view. You know, state policy and tax policy isn't made in a vacuum, right? And we have other states of the union and other potential competitors for new businesses and new companies. You know, it may not be fair, but I think we have to take what our competitors are doing into consideration when you contemplate, you know, raising, you know, corporate tax rates, for example, or closing loopholes. That doesn't seem to be the direction a lot of state governments are going in right now. I think most states are looking at where they can make expenditure cuts rather than focus on tax increases. If that's the way it's going, I would be, you know, I think we'd put us at a fairly competitive disadvantage for the state of Minnesota to go in the opposite direction. So that's why, you know, I would advocate looking more to the expenditure side than the tax revenue side at this point in time. Because we aren't getting the job growth we once had in the state of Minnesota. We're not getting the immigration into the state that we once had, and we can't take that immigration for granted. If we make one thing I see throughout my travels, and I do speak on the local economies in every market I go to on behalf of Wells Fargo, and one thing I know is that those states that have outperformance in terms of job growth and income growth all tend to have low tax rates overall. It attracts businesses. Businesses respond to cost of doing business. And they probably will be more sensitive to cost of doing business than they have been in the past, because their top line growth isn't as strong as it once was. So all businesses are still in this new economic normal where they need to pay attention to where they do business and the potential costs going forward. We ignore those risks at our own peril, and certainly put our long term economic growth in jeopardy when we do that.
Dr. Anderson, thank you very much for your testimony today. Members, thank you for some very good questions. We appreciate your feedback and your direction for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee is adjourned.